Two of our nation's founding fathers, Alexander Hamilton and Thomas Jefferson, they did not like each other. I don't mean, you know, the beef you have with your stepsister or your mother-in-law. These two really, really hated each other. Here is Alexander Hamilton describing Thomas Jefferson in writing in a letter to President George Washington. Here's Hamilton.
He is so seditious, so prostitute a character.
Yes, Alexander Hamilton, who is then the Treasury Secretary, is telling President George Washington that we cannot trust Thomas Jefferson. He is so seditious, meaning he wants to overthrow the government, and his character is a prostitute. Fighting words. But it gets even worse than that. Here is Hamilton again talking about Jefferson when they were in a fight.
There are approximately 1,010,300 words in the English language, but I could never string enough words together to properly express how much I want to hit you with a chair.
Oh, this is getting good. Historians debate whether or not Hamilton actually hit Jefferson with the chair or he said those words exactly, but we have his writing in quotes how much he hated Jefferson. And just before you start feeling sorry for Thomas Jefferson and calling Hamilton names, here is Thomas Jefferson in a letter to President George Washington talking about Hamilton. Here's Thomas Jefferson.
A man whose history is a tissue of machinations against the liberty of the country.
A tissue of machinations against the liberty of the country. Could you imagine you writing a letter about your coworker to your boss and accusing him, and I quote, machinations against the liberty of the country? In your case, you might be telling your boss that your coworker, who you are still going to work with on Monday, is planning on destroying the country, or in your case, your company. This is how much these two men disliked each other. The history books will tell you that the reason they were fighting was about what kind of government we'll have, small government or central government. But I'm here to tell you that they were fighting for something much, much, much more important, which was whether or not money, dollars, capitalism will become the religion of this new country. And you want to know who won out? I am a Jefferson fanboy, but Hamilton's vision of the world is why money rules the United States and, by extension, the rest of the world.
Amos talks the dollar.
Thomas Jefferson believed that putting the farmer, the small farmer, at the center of everything we did will help us as a country. In fact, here's Thomas Jefferson again, making his point about the kind of country he wanted us to be.
Agriculture is our wisest pursuit because it will, in the end, contribute most to real wealth, good morals, and happiness.
Yes, Jefferson is saying, if we put the small farmer at the center of everything we do, we will have real wealth. And he chose those words, real, on purpose. He also talks about good morals and happiness. Jefferson was a better politician than Hamilton because at that time, most of America in the 18th century was with Jefferson. And to put a final point in it, in 1791, Alexander Hamilton is trying to still make the case that we need to be a different country. So he writes letters to ordinary Americans and he's asking them how they were doing financially. He wanted them to put a price on their farm and their horse and everything they owned. And when they responded back to him in letters, he was very angry. Alexander Hamilton was very angry because the letters he got back was not what he wanted at all. They could not tell him their net worth. They could not tell him how much their farms were worth. Instead, they responded with human betterment numbers. They talked about things like, hey, because of our farm, our kids are not going hungry. There are fewer prostitutes around the corner. Crime is going down. Life expectancy and disease. And Hamilton was like, no, this is not what I want. I need you to think like a capitalist country. And at that time, we were not there. To help you understand how different it is, you may be thinking we've always been this money-centered country, but that was not true. In fact, at this time in America, if you had money to invest, the only thing you could invest in is in government bonds. That was it. We were just a country that was not centered around money. In fact, the way we measured progress was about human betterment, things like the letters Hamilton got, right? You know, what the literacy rates, diseases, those things. But Alexander Hamilton is on a mission to change that. So in 1792, Alexander Hamilton writes this big report to Congress. It's a report on the manufacturers, and we will have full copies of this on our site. But let me bring Hamilton back to read a portion of that report. Here's Alexander Hamilton.
It has been maintained that agriculture is not only the most productive, but the only productive species of industry. The reality is, suggestion in either aspect has, however, been verified by any accurate detail of facts and calculation. And the general argument, which are adduced to prove it, are rather subtle and paradoxical than solid or convincing.
Did you catch the shade he throws at Jefferson again? So here's what he says. He says, the reality of this suggestion, that agriculture is this productive good thing, has not been verified by any accurate detail of facts and calculations, and the arguments to prove it are either subtle and paradoxical. He is accusing Thomas Jefferson of magical thinking. He is saying, Thomas Jefferson, and those of you who think our country will continue to exist and grow by just being these cute little farmers, you people are on crack. We need something else because the evidence is on my side. Hamilton goes on in the report to continue to make the case. Here's Hamilton again humming for farmers. And you have to understand, most of America are full of farmers. Here's Hamilton again in his report to Congress.
The laborious farmers find it an exceedingly difficult task to pay their yearly taxes and supply their families with the necessities of life. And it would be impracticable to give employment in agriculture to any more than are already engaged. We can have no doubt of this if we consider the small extent of territory in Great Britain, the antiquity of its settlement, and the vast number of people it contains. It is rather overstocked with inhabitants, and were it not for its extensive commerce, it could not maintain near the number that it does at present. This is acknowledged on all hands. None but yourself would hazard absurdity of a denial.
Yes, Hamilton never misses an opportunity to jab at his old pal, Thomas Jefferson. Here again, he makes the case very clearly that look, for all this farming we are doing, these guys can barely pay their taxes. They're living paycheck to paycheck. He contrasts this with the UK and with Britain at the time. Britain has a smaller landmass, but they're doing quite well. And he makes the argument, the difference between us and Britain is capitalism, money at the center of everything we do. Hamilton was really laying it on thick with Congress because he was determined to make us a different America in the 18th century. If you were around in the 18th century, I, for one, I'm glad I am not, because the top issue of the day was slavery. So that would have been kind of awkward. And believe it or not, even slavery at that time was not about money, at least not then. You know, there were two sides to the slavery issue, right? You've got the folks who are the abolitionists, who's like the slavery thing is bad, and you've got the slave owners, the slave enthusiasts, who are like, yes, let's enslave other people. And I want you to pay attention to the arguments being made against slavery. So the prominent paper at that time is the Liberty Almanac, which was an abolitionist paper in the North. And in their newspaper, they point out that the reason why slavery is bad is that, look at the North. We've got all these schools, we've got colleges, we've got libraries and scholars, we've got an open society without slavery. It's a superior society. They do not make the case about money at all. They simply, again, go back to human betterment. The human beings are doing better in an open society, both black and white are doing better than in the South. So what were the arguments of the slave enthusiasts making? There's a man you might have heard in the news, John Calhoun. I think they took a statue down and they're relocating it or something. But I think this is a man that most Americans should really get to know. He started his career as a congressman in Congress. Then he was war secretary. Then he ran for president and he served multiple terms as vice president. He also happened to be an eloquent, aggressive defender of slavery and the South. Here's a little taste of John Calhoun.
The number of Negroes who are deaf and dumb, blind, idiots, and insane, paupers, and in prison in the states that have changed is 1 out of every 6. And in the states that have not, 1 out of every 154, or 22-1 against the former, as it compared with the latter.
In case you were not picking up what Calhoun was saying, because, you know, this is, after all, 19th century English. By the way, you should read John Calhoun. We've got plenty of his dealing there. When I read John Calhoun, I'm thinking to myself, this whole being a slave then in the 19th century wasn't so bad. He makes it sound so delicious.
Oh my God, bro.
Oh, hell no, man.
But what he is making the argument here is, he's saying for the so-called free people in the blacks, he's arguing that, right, the number of them, 1 out of every 6 blacks who are so-called free are either deaf and dumb and blind and idiots and insane or in prison. And then he goes, 1 out of every 154 in the South were the only ones who had this affliction, making the argument that life for black people so much better if they could just go back to the South and be locked in chains. The man is a terrific writer. You should read some of his work. So keep in mind, both the North and the South, the anti-slavery movement and the pro-slavery movement, were not talking about the value of the slaves in monetary terms, because again, we were not yet a capitalistic country. We were not yet a country that had money at the center of everything we did. They were making the argument around human betterment. It is just better for people for them to be free based on these social statistics, or for them to be in bondage based on these social statistics. Now, we are now in the 1840s, and this is all pre-capitalism, but the seeds that our friend Alexander Hamilton has planted is beginning to grow and the tree is getting mature. Now, the case for slavery may not be about money, but that is about to change, and change very, very quickly. So fast forward to the mid-19th century, and slavery is still the topic of the day. This is the pre-Civil War. And there's a senator in the South, Senator Hammond. He's on the Senate floor and he gives a short speech with the word slave appearing 21 times. He has taken the baton from Calhoun. This is the new generation of slave enthusiasts, the people who wanted to put people like me in chains. But this time, remember, you know, our friend Calhoun talked about blindness and people in prison and social betterments. Oh, no, we have graduated now. Something has now changed. He's addressing the North on the floor of the House. The title of the speech is Cotton is King. It's a wonderful, wonderful, wonderful speech. The content is obviously horrible, but wonderful oratory in defending this horrible practice of slavery. Here is our friend, Senator Hammond, as he talks about this issue.
In short, your whole class on of manual laborers or operatives, as you call them, are essentially slaves. The difference between us is that our slaves are hired for life and well compensated. There is no starvation, no begging, no want to employment among our people, and not too much employment either.
Yeah, if you're not tracking, here is our Senator Hammond making the case that, hey, look, being an employee in the North, you know, working an 8-to-5, that, according to him, is worse than just being an enslaved person. He points out that if you were an enslaved, if you're lucky enough to be enslaved in the South, you never have to fill out a job application again. You are always employed, right? And you have a job for life and you are well compensated, you know, with the occasional beating, of course.
No, please don't.
But he is not done. He makes the case again, and this time he talks about it. It's all about the Benjamins. Here is Senator Hammond again in that same speech.
The strength of a nation depends in a great measure upon its wealth. And the wealth of a nation is to be estimated by its surplus production.
Now he has your attention. He tells you that,
oh my God,
right? Enslavement is good. It's good for the wealth of our nation. Now he wants to drive the point home with the GDP. Show me the money. Show me the money, Senator. Here's Senator Hammond again.
If I might, in my calculations as to 220 million of surplus produce, there is not a nation on the face of the earth with any numerous population that can compete with us in produce per capita. It amounts to 16.66 per head, supposing that we are 12 million people. England, with all her accumulated wealth, with her concentrated and educated energy, makes but $16.50 per surplus production per head, of surplus production per head. I have not made a calculation as to the North with her 95 million surplus, admitting that she exports as much as we do, but with her 18 million of population, it would be but little over $12 a head.
The senator makes the argument here that in the South, they are doing a surplus of $220 million, which in his mind is $16.66 per head per capita. And he compares that with England. He's like, England, with all their fancy equipment and production and all of that, they are only doing $16.50 of surplus per head. So he is making the financial argument that the United States of America is a richer country. It's a wealthier country if we can continue this business of slavery.
What the?
And you see, for all the good the earlier abolitionist movement did, those who were against slavery, they did lots of campaigns. They made lots of moral arguments in the 18th century and the early 19th century. Americans were not really buying it. You know, like, it was like, okay, that's cool. I mean, life is better. Who cares? But then there was a change. It came in this author, Hinton Halper. He wrote this bestseller, And he abandoned all those moral arguments, and he made the argument about money. You see, we're now in the middle of the 19th century. We're no longer, Hamilton's vision is now starting to come to life. Here is Hinton Helper in his bestseller that he wrote in the middle of the 19th century.
The value of all property, real and personal, including slaves, in seven slave states, Virginia, North Carolina, Tennessee, Missouri, Arkansas, Florida, and Texas, is less than the real and personal estate, which is unquestionably property, in the single state of New York. Nay, worse, if eight entire slave states, Arkansas, Delaware, Florida, Maryland, Missouri, Mississippi, Tennessee, and Texas, and the District of Columbia, with all of their hordes of human merchandise, were put up at auction, New York could buy them all, and then have $133 million left in her pocket. Such is the amazing contrast between the freedom and slavery. Even in a puissonary point of view, when we come to compare the North with the South in regard to literature, general intelligence, incentive, genius, inventive genius, moral and religious enterprises, the discoveries in medicine, and the progress in the arts and sciences, we shall in every instance find the contrast equally great on the side of liberty.
Oh, his writing gives me chills. He makes the argument that if you take all the slave states together, at this point, if you missed that in Hinton's quote, remember when slavery was just about moral and this and that? Oh, no, America is now a completely different place. Hamilton is born. It's now about money. We now, at this point, now know how much the slaves were worth, right? They were now a property. You can now take loans against them. And Hinton makes the point that for all this wretchedness you're doing, if you add up all your cotton, all of that, the state of New York could buy the entire slave-owning South and still have change in its pocket. And he makes this argument so strongly that his book becomes banned in the South. They start burning his books because for the first time in America, right, the North wakes up to the fact that, wait a second, we have all this free labor. And Hinton points out that we still make, with free labor, we did $351.7 million last year. And then the South, with all of their slavery and enslaved people, only did $306 million. It was this fact, more than anything else, not the moral arguments, that got most of America, the majority of America, saying, you know what? This slavery thing may be a loser, not for moral reasons, but for financial reasons. The reason they were burning his book in the South was that even the people, the slave enthusiasts in the South who did not own plantations, were beginning to read this book and go, are we really better off with the slavery thing? And those who wanted to protect the status quo had to put this to an end. He was selling 500 copies a day at that time. And the truth about us is money, not morality, was what did in slavery, was what then gave President Lincoln the support he needed for the Civil War we would go on to have. America was now forever changed. The center of our lives was now money. As we left the mid-19th century, headed into the 20th century, money is now God. America has now transitioned from being, sure, a commercial system, we were always a commercial system from the beginning, to a capitalistic system, meaning it's the monetization of everything. Remember Hamilton in the beginning asking ordinary Americans what their net worth is and all of that, and they couldn't tell him? That forever changed. All of a sudden, capitalism, the way at least America defined capitalism, and we've exported to the rest of the world, is the monetization of everything, natural resources, the river, the air, the parks, works of art, education, human beings, both the enslaved and the so-called free people now had a dollar value, what they were worth from birth all the way to death. We viewed everything as financially viable and capable of, you know, giving us future returns. Once the dam broke in the mid-19th century, even slavery changed. Sure, slaves were always property from the very beginning for all the millennia that America practiced this evil act. But what really changed is your slave became an investment. You could take a loan against your slave. You could take insurance against them. You could rent them, right? America's relationship with everything became about money. So it is no surprise, as we get into the 20th century, you know, the New York Times had an article in 1910 that said an 8-pound baby was worth $362 a pound. They were already calculating its potential earnings, right? From the point it's a baby. So nothing we didn't have a monetary value. The whole using human betterment, how many prostitutes were in the corner, whatever you might think about it as being patriarchal, but at least it was about how literate were we, had diseases, all that went by the wayside. And the only thing that was at the center of how we measured progress became money. And so this continues, and we move on to a point where in the early 20th century, children became the preferred laborers in coal mining and textile. And the reason we did that was because they were cheaper and they were easier to control. And there weren't protests in the streets. It was just accepted norms, because all that mattered ultimately was how much money it could bring in. Money became our God. What started in the 18th century has continued all the way to today's date. Everything we measure now is now in dollars and cents. Money rules the world. Money is our God. I know there's some of you who would be offended by that. I do not mean that in that you go to a money church. I simply mean that money is at the center of everything we do. Every conversation we have, we've turned every part of American life to be focused on money. There is literally a price on everything. I know how much your precious little baby is worth. The government knows how much your life is worth, knows how much nature is worth, knows how much water is worth, knows how much air is worth. There's a literal price on everything. Remember at the start of the COVID pandemic in 2020? The debates around saving lives were focused on one topic. How much is it going to cost? Wherever you stood on the debate of, you know, shutdowns, what have you, in the end, the central conversation was really about what is this going to cost us? Because the only thing we know is to measure in money. Here is, to illustrate that point, here is the Lieutenant Governor of Texas on television in about March or April of 2020.
Says grandparents like himself, a lot of them would be willing to risk their lives to protect the economy.
No one reached out to me and said, as a senior citizen, are you willing to take a chance on your survival in exchange for keeping the America that all America loves for your children and grandchildren? And if that's the exchange, I'm all in. My message is that let's get back to work. Let's get back to living. Let's be smart about it. And those of us who are 70 plus, we'll take care of ourselves, but don't sacrifice the country.
Here is a governmental official making the argument. And he's been noble about it. Did you hear the tears, by the way? He is He is a hero. He's like, hey, listen, kids, I've had a good life. I am willing to be sacrificed on the altar of the Dow Jones. I have got a good life. I would rather die than kill the cash cow in America. Are you fucking kidding me? This is how much money has become the center of what we do. I think it's safe to say on the issue of Hamilton versus Jefferson, which is where we started, I asked a seemingly rhetorical question on who do you think won? Hamilton did. I'm not sure he wanted to win this much. I'm not sure he was a brilliant man, could have foreseen how money becomes the central topic, the central thing, the only thing that America worships. So mission accomplished, Alexander Hamilton. So the question though is for us here is, if money is America's religion now what? What are we supposed to do with that?
You've been listening to The Dollar. To view resources discussed in this episode, visit amostalks.com/The Dollar. Stay tuned for the next episode.
So one interesting thing about COVID that I don't know, Cassandra, if you paid attention to while it was happening was, if you noticed, as COVID happened, what did the government actually do to help its citizens in the United States? Did it open, shelters or places for people to go so that they're not, in tight spaces? Did it do any of that kind of deal? Nope, go home. And to the extent, what fucking home? Did it say, hey, if you are living with your abusive boyfriend, maybe you shouldn't go home to him. Here's where to go. Nope. It does the only thing it does. It goes to the temple of our God and it fucking sends out checks. Checks, by the way, that ended up being cashed. It was a report that did the whole thing by that abusive boyfriend of yours that you're now trapped with. Like, we didn't even have, if you really think about the response, we didn't have anything else compared to other countries that are less capitalistic. We didn't do anything other than go home, right? And here's some cash. It had no regard for what home I was going to. It had no regard for how am I going to social distance in my 200 square foot apartment. Like, it had none of that. It was simply, here's some money. Because that's all we need to do. If you talk about fixing anything, name any problem you think America has, what's the first thing we go into? How much are we spending on it? We just equate that if we spend more money on something, even though we spend more money per capita on healthcare than anyone else, and it's not even close. Yeah. And yet, Cassandra, we have some of the worst outcomes for any industrialized country. And it's because every year we put out a report that says we spent X number of dollars on this. We don't put out a report that says this is how people are getting healthier. This is how, no. It's all about how much we're spending. And we've all been conditioned. If I said to you right now that you're in the state of Mississippi is going to reduce healthcare spending by 50%. What's your reaction? What do you hear when I just said that? I'm going to reduce spending.
That you're going to reduce care.
Exactly. And the reality is that's not always true. Because right. The spending may be going to lobbyists. The spending is usually, and the way they measure the spending is always by using more spending. Right. It's like we measure healthcare costs by saying the flu cost the United States X billion dollars in productivity in a year. We spent X billion dollars in this. Now we've increased productivity, but it's all this, the human is no longer at the center of what we do. Human betterment is not what at the center. Money betterment is what at the center. And if humans get better along the way, so be it. But we are in the business of increasing how much money we have and almost nothing else.
That is so true. And it's amazing to me that me as a citizen, I equate dollars with care. I have been conditioned, indoctrinated to associate that. I don't ask how many fewer people this year have diabetes than the next year. So you're absolutely right.
It's all we've been conditioned to it. So I think people will be jarred to hear that fact. And I do try to I'm not shocked by any of this. Welcome to the deal. And I'm not actually pointing out that, oh, this is some moral failing or what have you. I just think it has consequences. And I would like to see us be very thoughtful about it, which we are not. So